Are you ready to unlock a secret to youthful vitality? Meet MitoPure, the revolutionary Urolithin A supplement from Timeline Nutrition. MitoPure ignites your body's natural anti-aging pathway, mitophagy. As we age, our cells can become damaged and dysfunctional. But with MitoPure, you can recycle these worn-out cells. MitoPure is a clinically validated solution backed by over 15 years of robust scientific research. Boost your cellular energy, enhance muscle strength and endurance, and even fight skin aging, all without changing your diet or exercise routine. I discovered MitoPure a couple of years ago after diving into the science of Urolithin A. Since then, it's become a vital part of my wellness routine. For more information and to order, visit timeline.com/Hoffman. Use code Hoffman at checkout to receive 10% off MitoPure. Whether you're looking to support muscle health, enhance your skin routine, or invest in your long-term vitality, MitoPure is your scientifically backed ally in the quest for slowing down the aging process. That's timeline.com/Hoffman for MitoPure. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. You know, a theme of Intelligent Medicine is to enhance your health and medical and nutritional literacy. And today we're going to focus on cardiovascular health and cardiovascular prevention with one of my favorite go-to experts. He's a point-and-shoot guy. You can point him at a subject, and his knowledge base is so encyclopedic that he is extremely informative. I think I know a lot about this, but I always learn in my conversations with today's guest, Neil Levin. Neil's the Senior Nutrition Education Manager and a product formulator for Now Foods and Protocol for Life Balance. Now Foods is the public-facing part of the company where you can buy it at retail stores. Protocol for Life Balance is the professional line. That is available to you via FullScript. Neil is a founder and former officer of the American Nutrition Association. He is a mover and shaker in the advocacy of nutrition, placing nutrition at the center of healthcare, and well-informed on a variety of subjects. So without further ado, Neil, it's a pleasure having you here on Intelligent Medicine. I hear you've been kind of busy. You've been traveling a fair amount these days.
I have. I've done several trainings around the United States, from Washington State to Massachusetts and Nashville down to Texas. So just in the last couple months. And last month I was in Romania doing trainings, and I just did a training, actually five trainings in the Middle East, from the Emirates to Kuwait, all across the Persian Gulf area, where practitioners, doctors, and pharmacists are very interested in using nutrition as part of their practice and wondering what the evidence is. And I go there about once a year for the last, 10 years or so, trying to inform them about these things. And then, I've developed a little bit of a following there. It's kind of interesting. I've addressed the Dubai Pediatric Club, which has 1,500 members in something like 40 countries, where, they do webinars as well as in-person trainings. So I've been fortunate enough to address that group a couple times as well.
And to think of these countries as backward or third world, that's entirely wrong, because the cities you've visited are fabulous palatial cities, that are rich on oil money. And they also are now devoting a considerable amount of their windfall to improving the health of their citizens, right?
Yeah, and then, in fact, our products are mostly sold through hospital dispensaries and pharmacies. And if you ever go to Dubai, the airport has drugstores, little pharmacies all through the airport, and in almost every one you can find our products.
Well, but that's fascinating. Now, contrast that here, where heads of medical departments in certain hospitals have said, over my dead body, will you put nutritional supplements in our formulary? I think this illustrates really kind of a gap in our healthcare system, where we have kind of a the medical orthodoxy anyway has kind of a blind eye towards the benefits of nutritional supplements, basically saying it makes expensive urine. And yet in other countries and very progressive countries, there's a lot of receptivity.
There is. And what they don't remember, our own physicians and people running hospitals, is that there are dietary supplements that are also sold as pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. There's a pharmaceutical fish oil. There's a pharmaceutical niacin, vitamin B3. There's pharmaceutical vitamin D. So it's not true that all these things are useless. And, you know, when I look at the NHANES studies, these are the national studies that are done every 5 years, and they survey Americans and estimate their dietary intake. Reviews of these studies show that men don't get enough magnesium. They're estimated to get 80% of the requirement, and virtually none of them get enough magnesium without supplementation. So ideally, you get everything you need from your diet, but many of us are on restricted diets and we're eating processed foods and different varieties of plants that were grown 50 or 100 years ago, different processing chemicals. The use of glyphosate on crops is intended to starve the weeds of minerals. That's exactly how it works. It chelates or bonds minerals so they're not available to the weeds. And being Roundup ready makes the genetically engineered crops more able to utilize the mineral content. Well, we have found glyphosate in studies in mother's milk,
yep,
in humans,
in the placenta,
and circulating.
It's ubiquitous.
And we know that this compound, this chemical, robs minerals. So if you're thinking you're getting enough minerals from your food and you're eating food that is exposed to glyphosate, not just GMO crops, genetically engineered crops, but now that they're using it to harvest wheat and other grains that are non-GMO, because if you use it early in the season, they don't have to cultivate and dig out the weeds because they kill them with chemicals. But if you do it late in the season, it's a way to speed and a uniform harvest of a crop like wheat, and to kind of desiccate, to dry it up and peel back where it's easier to get to the grains. So they're using it as a grain harvesting technique late in the season. It's still on the grain.
Yeah.
Half-life is about 6 months for glyphosate. So early in the season, maybe 6 months later, half of it's gone. But you spray it on right before harvest and it's all going to be there and soak right into the grain you're about to eat. So we're exposing people to more and more. And I've also seen a strong correlation between glyphosate use and hospital diagnosed celiac disease.
Uh-huh.
Why are so many people nowadays so wheat sensitive? Could it be the use of glyphosate?
Damaging the microbiome or damaging the intestinal immune system or causing altered intestinal permeability, so-called leaky gut syndrome. These are factors that are really quite likely to have contributed to this new onset disease. You know, they tend to say, oh, we just didn't know that people had celiac disease. And now we have a greater awareness. That's why we see the soaring incidence of that. Same argument applies to things like autism. They say, oh, well, it's not new. It's just we didn't recognize it. But no, clearly something's happening. I just want to ask you, though, you know, about the when you're in the Middle East, a century ago, I guess oil was discovered early in the 20th century. In these countries, it just revolutionized the economy of these countries. It also radically changed the health of the inhabitants of these countries who were formerly nomadic Bedouins, pastoralists, sort of lean and mean folks. And then suddenly they were exposed to the ravages of affluence and a Western diet. When you talk to them about cardiovascular health over there in those countries, you said a lot about some of the same issues we're seeing in the U.S., insulin resistance, a higher incidence of diabetes, premature cardiovascular disease all of a sudden in a population that once was unheard of.
Yes, absolutely. And the same thing's happening around the world. I've done trainings in China. I've had 5 trips to China to talk to practitioners and patients about the use of supplements and foods in treating diabetes. And it turned out there were 100 million diabetics in China 10 years ago.
Whoa.
And they're getting it because they want to convert to the Western diet. You see all the American big chains there with our modern American foods, the processed foods. And you see where there's a stronger emphasis on eating meat versus produce and having more convenient foods. They do tend to have a lot of variety in the diet. But as a vegetarian going to China, I'm very well aware that a lot of the meals are heavy on meat, where they probably weren't heavy on meat 20, 30, 50 years ago.
Exactly.
So the diet's changing to be more meat and more processed foods. And as a result, they have an explosion of diabetes.
Yeah, wasn't there a book about this, the China Paradox, or what was that, the book about, how China had been relatively free
of cancer?
What was it called again?
It was the China Study.
The China Study, yes, right.
I've actually got a book there back here that says the China Study. So
okay.
That I've read. And it has to do with you can actually reverse diabetes and cancer and things like that by switching to a vegetarian diet. And the more meat they're adding to the diet, it's a leading indicator. It's not necessarily just the meat, but it's a leading indicator that they're robbing their body of the plant-based nutrients and that they need in order to control cancer, diabetes, all these other things. And these researchers actually were able to turn cancer cells on and off by switching from vegan to non-vegan diets. So, it's interesting that they look at it at that level.
This is a great opportunity because I've eaten many pleasant meals with you, and we always find a place where you can get a vegetarian alternative, and you're a super healthy guy. And I'm kind of diametrically opposed. I'm a meat-based, low-carb kind of guy. It may be different strokes for different folks. I think we both achieved pretty high levels of health and well-being through different dietary paths. But it's an opportunity to talk to you a little bit about one theme that I'm pretty tuned into, which is the need for protein as one ages. This issue of sarcopenia, age-related muscle decline, which is inexorable. It speeds up when you're 70. I think it's like, every year you lose about 15% of your lean body mass, leading to frailty. What's your solution to that? You try to adhere to a vegan diet. Is it a ovo-lacto diet, or is it a pure vegan diet?
No, it's an ovo-lacto. Okay. I mean, there are some purist vegans who might look down on me, but I'm like, well, how long have you been doing this? I've been doing this for 52 years. I've been doing this when you couldn't go to a restaurant and get a vegetarian option.
Right.
I had friends who would go to McDonald's and order a Big Mac, hold the meat.
Wow.
It's not very nutritious, but it's fast food on the road.
Junk food vegetarianism sort of.
Right. So, I think the issue is, I've actually done lectures on the topic of plant versus animal sources of protein, especially whey protein versus plant protein. And if you're getting about 30% of your daily calories from protein, whether it's plant protein or not, you end up getting enough of the essential amino acids to, and you can make the other ones that aren't essential. That's why they're not essential amino acids, to have a healthy amount of protein and not only protein, but the muscle formulation. And one of the key signals of that is the amino acid leucine.
Yeah.
Leucine is one of the 3 branch chain amino acids.
Which is a little skimpy in some vegetarian foods, from my understanding, right? It's rich in muscle meat, the so-called branch chain amino acids.
Right. But when you get enough of protein in your diet, you're getting some protein from everything. A banana might give you 1 gram of protein, for example. There is protein in many foods, even if it's not complete protein. Most of the issue with complete protein is the difference between methionine or methionine and cysteine on one hand and lysine on the other. Mm-hmm. Grains are low in lysine, mm-hmm. and beans and legumes are low in methionine. When you combine them, you get enough of these branched chain and other essential amino acids you need, because there's so much difference between those in various specific categories.
This sounds a little bit like Francis Moore LaPay, Diet for a Small Planet, the protein combining notion, right?
Yeah, and the basis is getting the complete amino acid that you need from the essential amino acids. According to the National Academy of Sciences, we need about 5 grams of essential amino acids a day, and the branched chain are at the top. They represent about 40% by weight of the 9 essential amino acids you need, and it's a 2-to-1-to-1 ratio on the 3 branched chain amino acids of leucine to isoleucine and valine. So about 20% of the protein you need to take from essential amino acids is the amino acid leucine. And that's the one that controls the skeletal muscle stimulating process in the body. You need 2 to 3 grams a day to maximize that. And having more leucine does not add to the muscle creation, stimulating, or maintenance. Once you have
more,
that amount.
More is not better. It's sort of you reach your threshold.
You need sufficient.
Right. So do you supplement with leucine because it might be skimpy in some of the foods that you eat, or do you just?
I actually don't because I think I'm watching protein at my meals. When I travel, it's heavy on milk and eggs and beans. In the Middle East, they've got falafels and hummus and all kinds of bean-related things. So, I could typically get that. And in restaurants, they have baked beans, like the British style. So, that's another option. If you want the Western style of food, they've got the regular baked beans as well. And, of course, there it's all vegetarian baked beans. Here we have the Boston style with the meat added.
Pork and beans.
And vegetarians. Right. Vegetarian is not as common.
So the knock on vegetarian sources of protein is that often they're accompanied by a fair amount of starch. So people want to go very low carb, which we know can be salutary for people with metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance. If they utilize vegetarian protein, they're getting a fairly big dollop of albeit complex carbohydrates, but carbs, if they want to restrict their carbs a la, Atkins, et cetera.
Well, but we've also seen with legumes being a greater part of the diet. For example, that China study we were talking about, they found a direct correlation between the amount of beans and legumes consumed and healthy longevity. Beans make you feel more full, that they help you balance your blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
They help regulate blood sugar.
Possibly
they give you
the microbiome, protein. Et cetera, yeah.
Right. So they have benefits in that regard.
Fiber.
They do contain fiber. So, and animal foods don't in general. So, you need a certain amount of this, and people are only getting about a third of the fiber they need in America as well.
Mm-hmm.
Another issue. But, I think if you're getting legume-based proteins that, and of course, closer to a whole food is going to be better. If I'm eating black beans or chickpeas or some kind of pinto beans, I'm getting whole beans, which is better than extracting protein from these sources and just eating that, because then you're not getting the fiber and the other factors mm-hmm. that are affecting blood sugar positively, heart health positively, and creating that longevity scenario we were talking about.
Are you a fan of the faux meats of the, a possible burger and Beyond Meat and things like that? Because I remember when I was a vegan, I remember having, for Thanksgiving, I would have a tofurkey, and it was kind of hypocritical because it was like, okay, look, if you're so desirous of eating meat that you have to get a lump of tofu shaped like a turkey, what's it all about? Are you truly in the spirit of embracing a plant-based diet?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of those. The Impossible Burger, I refuse to eat.
Okay.
Because it is made, why is it impossible? Because it's made solely by genetic engineering.
Okay.
It's GMO.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to support a totally GMO source like that.
Mm-hmm.
I do eat, veggie burgers and things like that. Not every day,
mm-hmm.
And certainly more when I travel. for Thanksgiving, we buy this mushroom protein.
Okay.
Which is, you know, they harvest the mycelium from mushrooms and turn that into a meat substitute. And it's called corn, Q-U-O-R-N.
Yeah, yeah, corn. Corn, Q-U-O-R-N. It's a weird spelling.
It's a really weird name, it's a it's a mycoprotein where they use mushroom mycelium. And mushrooms, of course, are healthy for vegetarians especially. And they're savory, so it makes a nice... roast type thing. They make a roast. It's not shaped like a turkey or anything, but you know, it does have a turkey like kind of bland taste and a nice texture.
Okay, I have a couple more questions around the vegetarian controversies, but before we jump into that, maybe we'll save that for part two. Let's talk a little bit about supplements that are helpful for cardiovascular health. Recently, I guess it was you or one of the researchers at Protocol for Light Balance produced a very nice article for us, which is entitled, I have it here, Dietary Supplements for the Support of Cardiovascular Health. You can find it at drhoffman.com. Actually, it's by Celine, whom I've met, who's a lovely French lady who's a researcher and writer for you. So we kind of enumerate some of the supplements that are helpful. Can you take us through that, particularly with a view to what's available from Protocol for Light Balance?
Yes. Well, we're looking at a number of things that we know are heart healthy. One is coenzyme Q10, known as CoQ10. And CoQ10 is something that doesn't absorb very well. It's called ubiquinone because ubiquitous is the term meaning everywhere. And it's literally in every mammalian cell. It's used as a kind of an energy related compound, and it's produced in the same part of the liver that the cholesterol is produced in. So it has a if when you're taking statin drugs, you tend to cut your production in half.
With the HMGA CoA inhibition, it blocks the pathway that leads to cholesterol, but it also blocks the pathway that leads to synthesis of coenzyme Q10. So anybody who's taken a statin drug, and oh my goodness, you know, I went to my high school reunion and, you know, because I'm a doctor, they start talking, you know, health related matters.
Of course.
And, you know, everybody's on a statin. And, you know, I say, well, are you taking coenzyme Q10? You know, I'm not trying to talk them out of taking a statin because I don't know, you know, what their risk factors are. And the vast majority hadn't heard of it, or they heard of it, but they didn't think it was necessary. I think it should be mandatory if you're on a statin. It should be prescribed along with statins.
Yeah, one reason for that is so many people who are given the statins end up with muscle pains or other issues that
or even
are related to
it, or even heart
that they need this to replace that. And if they don't, they're going to get more side effects typically. Some of the people tolerate statins very well.
Yep.
Other people don't. But, you know, there are scientists who have suggested, let's put it in the water supply. It helps everybody. Well, not necessarily.
Yeah.
This is a drug. And it drugs, by definition, have side effects.
Yeah.
So that's why they're controlled substances. CoQ10 is necessary in the body and necessary to the cell. Nobody's deficient of statins. They might be deficient of other things that make them use statins as a remedy, but you know, they're not. And CoQ10 is needed for energetics. Where's about 20% of our energy is for the heart, about 20% is for the brain, and it could be more at times of high activity. And you need CoQ10 as part of that energy process. It's been described kind of like a spark plug in an engine that's helping you generate the ATP, which is the chemical storage form of energy in the body. And you use more energy in the heart. Most of the CoQ10 is in muscle, and the heart is a muscle. So you need this thing for energy. And if you're cutting it in half, you're not going to have energy. And if the muscles don't have energy, they're going to be sore and painful. So, you know, that's kind of the correlation there. Now, CoQ10 is a fat-soluble nutrient. You really have to take it with meals. If you take just a capsule on an empty stomach, you're not going to absorb very much. And there is another form that we sell called ubiquinol, which is ubiquinone and ubiquinol are very similar. One's an oxidized, one's a reduced or unoxidized form, but they're very interchangeable in the body.
Yep.
And if you take ubiquinone, the oxidized form, it actually reduces and becomes the antioxidant form, is converted in the intestinal lining. So no matter which form you take, you will get ubiquinol. Ubiquinol is then oxidized as that spark plug explosion in the cell that is generating electricity. Just like you need to burn the fuel in your engine and you need a spark. This is the spark in your cells that is creating energy there from, typically fatty acids, things like that.
I personally take your protocol for Life Balance, 200 milligram ubiquinol. That's the, first of all, the price point is excellent. It's very economical for that kind of quality form of coenzyme Q10. And it's a fairly high dose, 200 milligrams. So, taking that once or twice a day, I feel like I'm getting my adequate coenzyme Q10 in a bioavailable form. Now, there's a lot of controversy. You sound like you're a little ambivalent about this controversy. You're going to take CoQ10 or take ubiquinol. I think there's like a battle royal going on between the proponents of one or the other about, which is adequate, which is preferable.
Well, there are two attributes to ubiquinol that ubiquinone doesn't have. One is that it's the reduced form. It's not the oxidized form, which is a very, very minor difference. It doesn't affect bioavailability or anything like that.
Okay.
And ubiquinone is 90%+ converted to ubiquinol during absorption.
Anyway.
But the main difference is that you have to sell ubiquinol in a solubilized form. It has to be in a carrier.
Okay.
That makes it more soluble. So it's easier to digest. And that's the difference. The ubiquinol, it's not the form of CoQ10, it's the delivery system that makes the difference.
Okay.
And for some people who have good fat absorption, it doesn't make that much difference. And frankly, when you look at studies, it's more important you take it with several grams of fat in a meal or otherwise than what's in the capsule. There's never enough in the capsule to help you absorb it efficiently. So it actually makes more difference if you take it with or without food than what's in the capsule. So I always tell people, take it with a meal or take it with a spoonful of, fish oil, flax oil, coconut oil, whatever oil you're eating versus an empty stomach. And that's the main difference. But some people will absorb the ubiquinol better because of its delivery system. And I certainly don't knock that. But as a vegetarian, I don't have any vegetarian sources of ubiquinol. You can't sell it as a liquid because it will oxidize. It has to be in a soft gel, and nobody's making a vegan soft gel.
Okay, so you take CoQ10.
So I take 200 milligrams of CoQ10 twice a day with meals, and I think I have plenty of energy. I just went through a week of a killer schedule without traveling and with almost no caffeine.
I don't know how you do it, and I'm not going to blow your cover, but, you are at an age where adaptation to time change becomes problematic. I've experienced that, in my, as the years advance.
Yeah. I don't find jet lag is a problem because I don't sleep. I don't take naps or sleep on the plane. So I might be up for 24 hours before I sleep. So I'm sleep deprived. But then I go right to sleep and I wake up at a normal time and I'm on schedule. My digestion might take a day or two to catch up because it expects me to eat or go to the bathroom at a certain time.
Yeah.
But in terms of waking up or being sleepy, it's more sleep deprived than, the brain's not working properly because of the wrong cycle timing.
Okay. I want to talk about some other nutrients. But we divide our podcast in two parts. So, we're going to tease to part two where we're going to discuss, vitamin K, and its, role on vascular health, and also talk about, an interesting, combination supplement, that, invokes, multiple ingredients to support heart health. That's put out by Protocol for Life Balance. Grapeseed extract, another ingredient that's worth talking about. So when we return, clinical cardio 6, MK7, and grapeseed extract will be our subjects. And for more information and to order, to give you the heads up on this, just go to drhoffman.com/protocol for Light Balance. That's your portal to order physician quality products from PFLB, Protocol for Light Balance. That's drhoffman.com/protocol for Light Balance. And when we return, more on the subject of cardiovascular health with today's guest, Neil Levin. We'll be right back.